And I wanted to thank a lot of you who came in. I was just talking even to former co-residents who took a red eye after having been on call and had no sleep and are here this morning. So again, I really hope to not bore you to sleep. I myself, having had 2 hours and being on West Coast time, hopefully the jitters will keep me up. But again, thank you all for those who did come up earlier and who I haven't seen since med school. It's truly an honor and a privilege to be here. I would start with the pictures. Okay. So I was the eldest of three. I was born and raised in North Carolina, Salisbury to be specific. A lot of people will be like, what's that? And my response would be, proud producers of Food Lion and Cheerwine. And then most people would still be like, what's that? And then I would say, you know, where Bojangles came from? And they're like, yeah, maybe. And I'm like, that started 40 minutes south in Charlotte. So, you know, small town, ended up growing up in Raleigh, went to school at UNC, commuted from home first year, very much a triangle person. I was the doting older sister to Dia. Spent many nights in his room mapping out with sticky notes what high school and college courses to take. And the morning of his wedding day, this was actually at a sister Marriott in North Carolina, if you can tell from the artwork in the back. he asked me to comb his hair in preparation for his photo shoot. He was a 23-year-old, 6'3", basketball, and particularly Steph Curry fanatic. This was before Steph Curry was a thing. And he was really happy to be marrying Yusr. He had crushed on her since they were in grade school. They both grew up in the same community. They were kind of talked about as the Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie of Raleigh, North Carolina, within the Muslim community. And they were having a blast. And just a few weeks after their wedding, I'm back in North Carolina for a short trip, and I run upstairs to Dia's room, as I so often do late at night after everyone's gone to sleep, and I'm the big sister about to extract secret intel on how he's doing, and if there's any peer pressure, how he's doing in class, and it's the kind of tender relationship we had. And I'm going up to his room and asking him, so how's married life? And he proceeds to tell me, you know, Yusr is so amazing, I'm so happy, I love her so much. They were really excited. Dia was a second-year dental student at UNC Chapel Hill, and Yusr had just gotten accepted to join him at UNC Dental School, which was such a dream, right, for both to be going to the same school. My husband and I were long distance on two different coasts for 3.5 years, and I was like, you guys did this right. And she shared his love for basketball. They kicked off their marriage by going to an LA Lakers game, believe it or not. And let's see it here.
Oh!
Thank you. So going back to that night, I was waiting for a moment alone with him. Yusr had gone to sleep. We were at my parents' house. He was visiting. They were visiting from their apartment in Chapel Hill. And he says, I have something to show you. And he pulls out his laptop and he pulls out his CV that he had newly drafted, formatted it after mine. I was wondering why he had asked me for mine just shortly before. And he's looking at me eagerly, expectantly, looking up at his big sister, looking for that pride. And I looked down at it and I was in awe. I mean, my baby brother was like so obsessed with basketball, I was worried he would graduate. I was looking through his CV and was in awe at his leadership, his community service, his academic excellence. He was in top 10% of his class. And I looked at him and I told him, I've never been more proud of you than I am in this moment. Dia and Yusuf were planning a dental relief trip in the summer of 2015 that they were very excited about. He was going around in laundry baskets. My mom would ask him, can you not find anything a little more appealing than laundry baskets? But he was selling toothbrushes and toothpaste to try and raise funds for this trip. Let's take a look.
My name is Dia Barakat. I'm a dental student at UNC, and I need your help. Have you ever felt helpless about the situation in Syria and felt like you can't do anything about it? Well, this is your opportunity to help. This summer, I'm embarking on a trip to Turkey with 10 dentists to help Syrian refugee students in need of urgent dental care. We'll be doing extractions, fillings, root canals, and oral hygiene instruction to those most in need. We'll also focus on prevention. We'll be passing out toothbrushes and toothpaste within refugee camps so that we can eliminate the problem before it begins. We need your help to raise funds for these supplies and equipment, 100% of which will benefit the refugees.
Going back to that night, I had an early morning flight the next morning to go back to San Francisco. And it was about 2 a.m. I was standing in the middle of his room under his fan light fixture, and he gave me his classic bear hug, yanking my neck back because he was so tall and I was so petite, and just enveloping me in the way that he always had, and saying, I love you and I am who I am because of you. That was the last time I hugged him. Ten days later, I'm on call at UCSF San Francisco General. I was in the Peds Urgent Care Clinic, and I start receiving a barrage of text messages, which were confusing. I had just completed a cyst IND and was prescribing Clinda and trying to get it through the computer system and was just trying to get that done, but my phone kept blowing up. I excuse myself and go into an empty patient room, and call after call, I'm learning more and more information, and I learn that my baby brother, Lia, his wife of 6 weeks, Yusur, and her baby sister, Razan, who was visiting them for dinner, had been murdered, execution style, in the safety of their home, by a neighbor who didn't like the way that they looked. I get on a red eye to North Carolina, confused, not sure what's going on, not understanding what's happening. And I run up to Dia's room the way I had done so many times before. I had been numb, in shock, not really able to process anything, only to find a void that will never be filled. Investigation and autopsy reports later reveal the sequence of events. Dia was getting home. He was coming off the bus from campus in Chapel Hill. They lived really close to campus in a community with a lot of graduate students. And Razan was visiting for dinner, and their neighbor proceeded to knock on their door. Dia opened, and he proceeded to shoot at him. He then looks left, and with a single shot to Yusur's hip, immobilizing her, coming from behind her, on her knees, behind her head, reading autopsy reports as a physician and of your young, healthy family members was probably one of the worst things I've ever had to do in my life, but with a single bullet lacerated her midbrain. He then proceeded to Razan, who was screaming for her life on her knees, and with a single bullet to the back of her head, killed her. growing up in North Carolina and going to medical school at UNC, I was in a different city practically every 6 weeks for rotations. I was used to the stares, the palpable fear. I was used to patients, even in Raleigh, refusing to shake my hand. I was scrubbed into the OR in an open abdominal surgery, holding a scalpel, shaking, as an attending was having a debate about religion with me. I was in ENT clinic being yelled at and verbally harassed and threatened by a patient in front of nursing, in front of my attending, in front of the waiting room, in front of the entire staff, only to be told, as my knees were trembling, he's not someone to discuss religion with, as if I had been the one to bring it up. I was in the ED in San Francisco, and I was busy trying to figure out whether my patient needed to be have her care escalated to the ICU, frantically putting in orders, only to be asked by the nurse about my proposed solution to the Israel-Palestine conflict. We laugh, but this happens all the time. So much so that I thought, okay, what is, you know, my reaction at the time was to smile, you know, win them over with kindness. Because for many people, I really was the only Muslim they had ever met. But the honest truth is I was exhausted. I was tired of carrying that burden, feeling like every verbal or nonverbal encounter, I was being judged by it. It wasn't until life experiences later that I recognized that the act of humanizing a human is in itself dehumanizing. When the tragedy happened, that was also kind of an obvious turning point in my life, that smiling didn't have the effect we would have hoped or believed that it would. When Yusor was moving into Dia's apartment, just a mere weeks prior to what had happened, Yusor's mom, who also wears the hijab, was helping her move in when their neighbor came up to them and said some belligerent comments and to the fact that he didn't like the way that they looked. And Yusor's mom responded to her and said, you know, in Islam we're taught to be kind to our neighbors. Be kind to him. With time, he will see who you are. Now, unfortunately, that's not how things played out. And despite the smiling, he still put a pistol to her scalpel and pulled the trigger. Not long after coming back to work, I took a 2-month leave, and I was the senior resident on rounds, and one of my patients looks over to a colleague, gestures around her face, and says, San Bernardino, referencing a recent terrorist attack. Now, I had just lost 3 members to Islamophobia. I was a vocal advocate within my own program about how to deal with such microaggressions, and yet there was silence. I was confused, humiliated, disheartened. I was amongst people I love, people who love me, who are social justice warriors in their own right. And yet no one said anything. 4 days later, I'm rounding on the same patient and she looks at me and says, your people are killing people in Los Angeles. At this point, I cross my arms, I sit back, I look around expectantly. And again, no one says a word. And this was a team of residents, my attending, medical students, pharmacy, social work, you name it. And I'm the senior, right? How does that make me feel? Oh, the patient had terminal lung cancer, she can kind of say whatever she wants. No, she can't. You can still be respectful and compassionate without crossing someone else's boundary and line and respect. So I sat down on her bed, and I looked her in the eye, and I told her, "Have I done anything but treat you with kindness and respect? Have I done anything but give you compassionate care?" And she looked down, and in that moment, she realized what she said was wrong. And in front of the entire team, she apologized and said, "What I did was wrong." She said, "I'm Mexican American. I receive this kind of treatment all the time as well." Many of us experience microaggressions on a daily basis. Many of you here experience it for your race, your gender, your sexuality, your religious beliefs. We've all been in situations where we witnessed something wrong, but didn't do anything about it. I've had to ask myself the question of why. Why is that the case? I really couldn't understand it. And I realized, I was talking to Dr. Bayat Steiner yesterday, and he said this was similar to an analogy when you ask someone a sexual history. It takes practice to really be able to ask that uncomfortable question or address that uncomfortable moment. This is no different. Maybe we didn't have the tools in our pocket to respond in the moment. We all carry implicit biases. It's not a matter of if we carry them, it's how aware we are of our innate privileges and the implicit biases that we bring to the table. We can all agree that bigotry is unacceptable, but when we see it, we're silent because it makes us uncomfortable. What we can do is step into that discomfort, and by doing that, that's our first step to stepping into the allyship zone. With that patient who practically called me a terrorist, it wasn't enough that her and I had resolution. 4 days later, I was doing a thora on her and we were having a chat like nothing happened. But what's to say that the next resident who looks like me, who's rotating through, who a patient says something offensive, that the same thing doesn't happen again? And that's where the institutions come in. That's where our organizations come in. And the responsibility from our senior leadership comes in to ensure that this doesn't happen again. There was a term, I was talking with my husband yesterday trying to figure out how to frame this. And he comes from the world of tech, so open source is actually something that I thought was really beautiful. Open sourcing your advocacy, allowing you all as educators to play a facilitative role in allowing your residents and your students and your learners to come and pursue these advocacy efforts. An example of what happened after the incident at our institution is others were mobilized around me and said, "This is not okay. What are we going to do about it?" And as a team effort and leadership responding and listening, we had a grand round that discussed countering Islamophobia. There was a UCSF teach-in where classes were canceled for all students for them to attend and discuss the ramifications of Islamophobia and how they manifest within colleagues, but also with patients. In essence, the organization basically lent its full-on support. I had our CMO emailing me and asking me, "We've had questions about having hijab-appropriate attire in the OR. What kind of caps would you prefer?" That's the kind of thing that I'm talking about. It was a demonstration of support. people ask, okay, so what do I do effectively about this? And the reality is there is no guidebook to how to deal with this. Every situation is going to be different. Many of you, I'm sure, are probably familiar with the incident with Starbucks just about a week ago, where two black men were arrested. What did Starbucks do? They decided to shut down all Starbucks stores for an entire day and provide their staff with training on implicit bias. Is that going to fix the problem? It's definitely a first step in the right direction, and if anything, it at least indicates to their members that they are invested and committed in lending their support. So when organizations signal that willingness to adapt and grow and to better serve their constituents, they're serving not just their learners, but their patients alike. And not all forms of advocacy have to be so uncomfortable. Sometimes there are low-hanging fruits that make good opportunities for us to affect change. At UCSF, I was part of the refugee health clinic pathway, where we were trained to do refugee and asylee training, health screenings. And by virtue of just being an Arabic-speaking provider, one of two or three in the entire county, my panel ended up having over a quarter of Arabic-speaking patients. And I had patients who were rolling through, you know, tremendous trauma histories, underserved patient populations. I'll never forget when a 13-year-old came into my clinic, a refugee from Yemen, separated from her mom, who was still in war-torn Yemen. And she was not really sharing much with me, but was opening up a little bit because I can speak Arabic. And I realized on her physical exam that she had slits on her wrist. And when I finally started to kind of establish rapport and learn a little more what was happening, she was being bullied at school. She didn't feel welcomed. She was severely depressed. She had no one to talk to. The obvious next step is, okay, I'm referring her to behavioral health. We're gonna get her plugged in. We're not gonna let her leave until we make sure that she's not actively suicidal. Well, there's not a single Arabic-speaking mental health provider. She refused to use the interpreter because they couldn't interpret well. These were things we weren't really aware of. I had another patient who's a Iraqi with hearing loss from bomb detonations, who was illiterate, who had a low IQ, who had poorly controlled diabetes, who you couldn't put on insulin because of those concerns. I couldn't do this alone. I tried to refer him to diabetes teaching to help him on carb counting and, you know, taking his medications, only to get reports back unable to conduct visit due to impossibility of interpreter services. And it took kind of this anecdotal, you know, experience and this pattern to emerge, and part of our QI project and our community advocacy kind of portions of our curriculum that allowed us to kind of explore further, we were able to identify, and I was able to do focus groups within the county and realize that one of the top barriers of access to care, not good care, access to care, was quality interpretive services. And that in itself became, you know, when we're talking about more confusing things like implicit bias and how to stand up and be an ally, this was a relatively simple fix. Now, not simple from a funding standpoint, but simple, like we've identified a problem. And our program was invested in it and worked with different departments, with OB and pediatrics, and we hired an in-person interpreter who was able to be on call with a pager to be able to be available amongst all these different departments. So it's definitely possible. So ask yourselves the question, how many times have residents or medical students come up to you and approached you with an idea on how to better serve the patient population? And what kind of runway were you able to provide them and give them to pursue those interests? These are hard issues, and They've only been made harder by the climate that has polarized society today. I'm here because I made a commitment to Dia, Yusur, and Razan 3 years ago to try and make sure this never happens again. And yet, unfortunately, things have only worsened. The Muslim ban was, at the time, just a figurative campaigning strategy. And yet, here we are debating it in the highest court of the land, where it will likely be upheld. Hate crimes have risen for American Muslims more than they have for any other minority group in the last few years. And it should come as no surprise that hate crimes against Muslims rise in parallel to presidential elections, not to terrorist attacks. Anti-Muslim hate groups since 2015 have tripled. I'll be the first to admit, and I have witnesses here who have seen my journey, my challenges, my, at times, despair in asking, what is the point? Where is their meaning? Where is their purpose? And I always found it coming back to work and being able to provide care in a compassionate manner for every single patient, to try and be mindful about providing dignity in every interaction that I have. That was what gave me meaning in those particular small moments. I was at a training recently with Professor Marshall Ganz. He's a Harvard Kennedy government professor who has a long history in leading social movements and the grassroots movements. And he said something that I clung on to and I think is really powerful, particularly as we're trying to figure out these times of basically hope without criticality is delusion. Criticality without hope is despair. It takes both hope and criticality to lead to transformative change. So what does that mean for us? I leave you with three asks. Number one is we be allies for one another. We stand in solidarity with one another. And what does that mean? Because we all agree intellectually we have to do that, but what does that actually mean? It took going through a lot of these patient and colleague encounters myself to try and determine what is it that would be helpful. And it was two things. It was that you respond, anything. Prime yourself with saying, hey, that's not okay. To give yourself the extra couple seconds to think about the more appropriate, adequate response. And two, that it's timely. That you do it in that moment before it passes you. And that's not an easy feat, but it's something that we should hold ourselves up for. The other thing is realizing that as we are in positions of leadership or seniority or power, that the responsibility does lie on us ultimately to ensure that we are providing our learners the safe space to feel protected and safe and valued and welcomed. I thought we can try and demonstrate this. I've done this a couple of times where, you know, when people ask, so what do we do? And again, it's an intellectual thing, but bear with me, okay? So anytime I'm gonna say something that's slightly like not cool, that are all based on real events, we're all gonna say, hey, that's not okay, okay? All right, so a patient was saying to one of my gay attendings, you don't look like a woman.
Yeah, that's
not okay. All right. A patient to a co-female resident saying, I don't want to talk to you. Get me the doctor.
Yeah, that's not okay.
An attending to a medical student Your faith preaches violence.
Hey, that's okay.
Great, I think my job here is done today. So I ask you today that if you see someone like me going through a situation like I went through, can I count on you to be an ally?
Yes.
If you see someone like me going through a situation that I went through, can I count on you to be brave and to jump in and to say that I will not let this happen?
Yes.
Awesome. Thank you. But wouldn't it be great? I'm not done. You guys thought my job was done. It's not that easy, you guys. Sorry, thank you so much, but I'm not done. Wouldn't it be great if it was that easy, right? And in so many ways it is, because if we can prime ourselves in that moment to be allies for one another, that goes a long way. But we can't change behavior without first being aware of it. And that's where the implicit biases comes in. So my second ask is that when you go home today and when you go back to your programs, is that you invest some time in taking the Harvard Implicit Association test. You can take it in different categories. I'll be the first to say that I flunked most of them. But that's to say, again, it's not a matter of if we have them. We all do. But we need to be better aware of them so we can address those issues when we face them. Research study after research study has shown us the same things. I was trying to see kind of different levels of training, how that manifests. In medical school, they looked at AOA inductions. And white students were 6 times as likely as blacks to be inducted. In EM residency, while men and women residency learners at the beginning of their training had comparable performance evaluations, fast forward to the end of their training, and men performed significantly better on these evaluations, affecting their hiring, their professional trajectories, and perception. The faculty level, if they were, they did a cross-section on grand round speakers and who gets invited to present these lectures, and women were significantly underrepresented compared to the composition of the group that they were a part of. But here's the thing, it doesn't just affect learners and educators and employment and hiring and professional trajectories and whether or not you make it to faculty. What's almost even more compelling is the data shows us that implicit biases perpetuate health disparities, affecting physician behavior and patient outcomes. Two well-documented kind of classic examples are in prescribing opiates postoperatively and prescribing thrombolytics, both of which demonstrated that blacks were significantly less likely to get treated than whites. I don't know how many of you have heard of Serena Williams' recent birth story, which I thought was fascinating, and as I read this the literature here, I was like, oh my gosh, this is an example just playing itself out. She was at higher risk of developing a PE. She's developed one before, and after delivery, she went up to the nurse's station saying, I think I have a clot, I need thrombolytics. And she was dismissed, and she had to advocate for herself. And this was Serena Williams. It's real. My third ask is to open source your advocacy and as institutions signal your commitment to your leaders. The nature of the work is that it's not top down, it's bottom up. And you need to give them the space, the resources, and the bandwidth to be able to pursue their interests. Everyone here, we chose family medicine, I can probably guarantee, not for the money. We chose to serve our respective communities. We chose to champion the voices of those who are unheard. We came into this field to help eradicate health disparities. We came into it to honor the tremendous privilege that patients place in us and entrust us with on a daily basis. I want you to look around and see the faces that are here, see the people that are here. I was telling you when I first walked in, as I'm struggling to find a sense of meaning and purpose at times, or who am I and what is my calling? And I really meant it when I said these people are my people. I have found an alignment of values and drive and values, I think is a good word. And for that, I'm tremendously honored to be sharing this platform with you. I believe in this room. I believe in all of you. The mere fact that here today stands a petite Arab American Muslim hijab wearing new mom woman, I think it says a lot. And it's a huge testament to the organizers who have put this together and have basically said that we value and put and weigh the importance on addressing issues of inclusion and awareness. And for that, I am tremendously thankful. Thank you so much for having me.